You are listening to the Pronk Pop Show, presented by Raymond Thomas Pronk, the People's Paladin Pronk, propagating faith, family, friends, freedom first. Broadcasted by Renaissance Radio, Radiating Reason, and KDUX Web Radio. Podcasted by PronkPops.wordpress.com and KDUXWebRadio.wordpress.com. You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas, with a voice of Richland College. My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of KDUX Web Radio, Richland College, or the Dallas County Community College District. Welcome to the Pronk Pop Show. This is the Thursday edition. While we have some good news on the international scene, namely a ceasefire, although Turkey does not want to call it a ceasefire, that Vice President Mike Pence and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo negotiated with Erdogan in Turkey, the president of Turkey. What's going on here? Well, I think the reason the Vice President and the Secretary of State went to Turkey is to try to make it very, very clear that we don't want Turkey to engage in wholesale slaughter of the Kurds, especially those militias. And they're usually referred to as the YPK by Turkey because they consider the YPK terrorist and associated with, and they are, with the PKK that the United States and Turkey considers to be terrorists. But an important point here for those that don't follow this. The reason why the Islamic State, or one of the reasons why the Islamic State was virtually destroyed, was we had an ally that was doing the fighting, and that was the Kurds. Keep that in mind, because the Islamic State were radical jihadists. They were, first of all, they were Sunni in terms of their religion, that branch of Islam, which is the majority branch. And they would kill people of the other branch, the Shia, and Persians or Iranians, but also Kurds, even though most of the Kurds are Sunni. And that's why you need to understand the religious as well as the ethnic groups involved to understand who the players are. And I remember when Obama was president, he decided not to get involved in it. And I thought it was the correct decision. Now, we did get involved in it, supposedly short term. That turned out to be a 10-year commitment. The American people are weary and, frankly, tired of sending their children, I shouldn't say children, their sons and daughters that are in the armed forces to foreign countries where many of them die. Thousands of them have died, and many, many tens of thousands more have been seriously wounded. And it's in particular, what has changed? The big change is the United States today, for all practical purposes, is independent from, doesn't need imports of oil anymore because we found major reserves of oil and natural gas in the United States using, for example, the technology of cracking to break up the tight soil so that, for example, both oil and natural gas can flow out and up the pipes. So because of that, we are now a net exporter. For many, many years after World War II, we weren't, and we were increasingly dependent on the Middle East, both Saudi Arabia, Iran, and the countries in the Middle East for oil. No longer are we that dependent. So what Donald Trump, President Trump, wants to do, and I believe he has the backing of the American people, is, first of all, bring the troops home, but more importantly, fundamentally change the foreign policy of this nation, which ever since the end of World War II has been one of intervening in country after country. Today, hey, we are the only superpower. We are what's called the hegemon. And we have groups in this country that support this policy, including the political elitist establishment of both Democrats and Republicans. That's why when Donald Trump, now I want to make clear, because I'm getting a little bit tired of the lies of the progressive propaganda wing, not only of the Democratic Party, but of big lie media, the television network, saying that Donald Trump gave the green light, and that's the phrase they use, the green light for Turkey to invade Syria. No, he didn't. He didn't want it. He opposed it. But he understood why Turkey wants it, because the Kurd militias are right on their border. Remember, this is northeastern Syria. Syria is a big country, keep in mind. And the Assad regime, together with the Russians and the Iranians that back Assad, that civil war was won by Assad. There was no good side. That's the point I've made in several shows. And when there's no good side, you should mind your own business and stay out of it. Yet, we had one slight problem we needed to totally destroy, as best we can, ISIS. We did, but who did most of the fighting? It was the Kurds. The Kurds were a good ally. You know, an enemy of my enemy is in this case, it. The Kurds were the enemy of the Islamic State. And keep in mind, Turkey allowed people from all over the world to go through Turkey into Syria to join the Islamic State. And you had one of our allies was enabling the establishment of the Islamic State. And then you had Saudi Arabia, another of our ally, funding the Islamic State, providing the money for the weapons. And initially, when they were successful, they were selling oil to raise money. Ultimately, they failed when they were up against a well-trained militia or fighting force. And what we provided the Kurds was, first of all, intelligence from our satellites, our fighter aircraft, F-16s, for example, that would strafe or bomb targets. And we are special forces, special operatives, if you will, provided training. So it was very much a joint effort, but the Kurds lost over 11,000 people. But ultimately, it succeeded, and that's why the Islamic State is no more, but you still have prisoners. I keep getting conflicting numbers, but up to 10,000, maybe more, maybe a little less, of those Islamic State fighters that survived. And they're in prisoner of war camps. The question is, if the Kurds are controlling the area, they will keep their enemies in those prison camps. They don't want, and neither does the United States wants, the Islamic State to rise again to fight another day. So Turkey, for the last week, has invaded, they have invaded, but a lot of countries have invaded Syria, that border between Syria and Turkey. And what's going on? I think what they want to do is slaughter the Kurds, especially the militia in the area. And we're starting to hear some horror stories. President Trump, after being criticized by both Democrats and Republicans in the House and the Senate, wanted to push back. In other words, tell Erdogan in no uncertain terms, this has to stop. And President Trump said sent his vice president, secretary of state, to talk to him. And what you need to understand is Turkey is part of NATO. It is part of NATO and have a very large army. And they bought a lot of weapons from us. But what's getting the United States' attention is they recently bought some anti-missile defenses from the Russians. President Trump put sanctions on Turkey, on steel. Now, today, it was announced that they're not putting any additional sanctions on. And the big breakthrough is, it's not much of a breakthrough. I know we're trying to make the best of it. The Kurds will be given 5 days to get out of that roughly 20-mile buffer zone from the Turkey border into Syria. And it's a very long border along the southern part of Turkey. So it's a retreat, if you will. I mean, you're basically telling our allies, get out. Now, if they get out of that 20-mile buffer zone, and there's no real clear idea where they're going, The Kurds control a large part of northeastern Syria. The Syrian regime is largely on the coast, on the Mediterranean coast, and the Russians, the reason, you know, they're trying to sell equipment to Syria, they're big supporters of the Assad regime, but the major reason they're doing that, they want a port on the Mediterranean, and they have one, that their vessels, naval vessels, can both get repairs, resupply when they come into port for food, things like that, fuel. And then the Iranians supported Assad. Because Assad was an early supporter of the revolution that overthrew the Shah of Iran. So you need to know the key players. Now, the United States, and I know President Trump, doesn't want to have blood on his hands in terms of another genocide. I bring it up because, about 100 years ago, for several years, the Turks systematically killed the Armenians, Christians. We don't want a replay of that with the Kurds. Now, the Kurds aren't Christians, but they are religious minorities in these areas. And this specific area is largely controlled by the Kurds. We're getting news stories, though, with the United States pulling out of the area. Now, I support President Trump's efforts to fundamentally change the foreign policy of the United States. In other words, none of this nation-building nonsense and policemen of the world. We need to specifically, and I won't say narrowly, but be very specific is what is the national interest. We simply do not have the economic resources or the luxury anymore to intervene in country after country. So you need to withdraw, but when you withdraw, you shouldn't cause a worse situation. And Donald Trump faced major criticisms from both parties because, and it's a natural sentiment, that you don't stab our allies in the back, and that's how it's been perceived. This, in a certain extent, was a public relations disaster. It simply could have been better handled. I think Donald Trump knows that. He's trying to recover from it. It just seemed like, how should I say this? You can't just talk to Turkey. You really need to bring your military advisors, foreign affairs advisors, and you need to sort of map out a plan. Okay, we agree with you, Mr. President, not that I have much to say in it, that we want to withdraw. How can we do that in an orderly fashion without hurting or destroying the allies that, remember, Mr. President, destroyed the Islamic State? I think there are many foreigners today are waking up to the fact that the United States now, given its financial situation, that's why I say the biggest threat to our national security is the fact that government spending is out of control. Every year we have bigger and bigger deficits, hundreds of billions of dollars, which reminds me, I need to double check whether or not we finally got the fiscal year 2019. What was the deficit? It's going to be somewhere between 900 and 1,000 billion. It's going back over $1 trillion, which is 1,000 billion. You just can't keep doing this. It does crash down. And there's no leadership in Washington that I can perceive that is trying to be financially responsible. And I include Donald Trump in that. We have two big government parties. Oh, they differ on what they want to spend the money on, but the only way we can pay the bills now is to borrow, 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 and we're so much in debt. It's not just the national debt, it's the fact that we have obligations. Our unfunded obligations, also called liabilities, are over $200 trillion. I said $200 trillion. That's more than 10 times what the total real gross domestic product. That's why I keep saying you can't keep doing this. Eventually, it crashes down. And we see nobody today calling for closing of federal departments. The Democratic Party wants to just spend more and more money. So they're a lost cause. I think, they're incompetent. And frankly, they want to turn this country into a socialist state, which will destroy it. They don't learn from history. They repeat history. But that's true of both parties. My philosophy is one of limited government. It used to be called liberalism. In Europe, it still is. Today, I have to modify that, is classical liberalism. You see, up until really 1930, the federal government, although it did vary from year to year, was typically less than 3% of the total goods and services produced. In other words, we had a federal government, a centralized government, but it was small. And it largely was financed for most of our history through tariffs on goods being imported into the country. However, with the passage and ratification of the income tax, together with the creation of a central bank, the Federal Reserve System, you know, starting in 1914 on, the means of expanding the federal government were in place. As a result, we get most of our money today from personal income taxes, corporate income taxes, capital gains taxes. And at one time, both Democrats and Republicans believed in financial responsibility or fiscal responsibility. No longer. We've gone crazy. Think of it as someone that lives beyond a salary by has a dozen or more credit cards, assuming you can get them. We say charge it, and that means we issue treasury securities. Now, that's great if you can do it, but at some point, we're not going to be able to. And I know I sound like a broken record here, but that's going to happen, in my mind, in the next roughly 10 years. It could happen a lot sooner, though. We just have spent too much money for too long. It's all, this house of cards is coming down, fellas. There is a day of reckoning. And I go on about this because one of the areas we've spent a lot of money is on the military and in intervening in all these countries. It all adds up. And we're burdening future generations. That's the really immoral thing. It's one thing if you borrow money and you're truly making an investment. And we have some of that. But most of what we've spent our money on, the big bucks, are in wars. I give you this preamble because I agree with Donald Trump. It's time to change, fundamentally change our foreign policy from one of intervening in country after country. And the reason is we can't afford it, but more importantly, it's not in our national interest anymore. Who is Donald Trump facing? There are defense contractors that don't like that. There are also generals, admirals that don't like that. You have the neocons that there's almost not a war that they don't want to intervene on. Now, I'm not saying that we shouldn't have a strong national defense. We should, because there are people that don't wish as well. I'm not one of these people that thinks you can do away with the military. That's not an answer. You need to defend this country against its enemy, rivals, enemies, however you want to characterize them, because they're out there and they don't wish as well. So I wanted to play the press conference, Secretary of State Pompeo today. It lasted, roughly 15, 20 minutes. I'm not going to play all the questions. I made a decision there that I could. We'll see. Now, I have other stories that I'll get to, one being the resignation of Rick Perry and the situation at the border in terms of what Congress is trying to get passed. Okay, here is at the U.S. Embassy today, Ankara, Vice President Pence.
Thanks to the strong leadership of President Donald Trump and the strong relationship between President Erdogan and Turkey and the United States of America, that today the United States and Turkey have agreed to a ceasefire in Syria. The Turkish side will pause Operation Peace Spring in order to allow for the withdrawal of YPG forces from the safe zone for 120 hours. All military operations under Operation Peace Spring will be paused, and Operation Peace Spring will be halted entirely on completion of the withdrawal. Our administration has already been in contact with Syrian Defense Forces, and we have already begun to facilitate their safe withdrawal from the nearly 20-mile wide safe zone area.
Now, I want to make clear, because this can get easily confusing. The Syrian Defense Forces are the Kurdish militia, also known as YPK, also YPG. Those are the women. So the basic deal is you got 5 days to get out of this area. These are our Kurdish allies. And then once the Kurds do that, Turkey has agreed to stop this invasion of Syria. What remains to be seen is, and supposedly the Kurds have agreed to this, but what about Turkey? Because there have been reports that Turkey-backed groups of people, call them irregulars, I don't know what you would call them, to go in there and kill people. And I think that's why this quickly escalated. And it remains to be seen, once The Kurds are out, and I think they'll get out. What are they up against? They're up against a large army with artillery and fighter aircraft. Kurds don't have that capability. They're very good fighters, but they simply don't have that capability. They were able to basically destroy the Islamic State. But when you're up against a modern army, whether it's the United States or Turkey, artillery is indiscriminate. You don't know exactly where it's going to land, and it has landed in towns, killing civilians. So let's continue.
South of the Turkish border in Syria. Let me say this also includes an agreement by Turkey to engage in no military action against the community of Kobani. And in addition, the United States and Turkey have both mutually committed to a peaceful resolution and future for the safe zone, working on an international basis to ensure that peace and security defines this border region of Syria. In addition to the settlement today with the ceasefire, Turkey and the United States mutually committed to the defeat ISIS activities in northeast Syria. This will also include an agreement renewed today to coordinate efforts on detention facilities and internally displaced persons in formerly ISIS-controlled areas. Also, Turkey and the United States agreed on the priority of respecting vulnerable human life, human rights, and particularly the protection of religious and ethnic communities in the region. I spoke to President Trump just a few moments ago, and I know the president is very grateful for President Erdogan's willingness to step forward and to enact this ceasefire and to give an opportunity for a peaceful solution of this conflict that commenced 1 week ago. For my part, I'm grateful for the president's leadership. I'm grateful for the more than 5 hours of negotiations with President Erdogan and his team that arrived at a solution that we believe will save lives. And let me also say I'm very grateful for this team, and to be able to have alongside the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, our National Security Advisor, Robert O'Brien, Ambassador Jim Jeffries and Ambassador David Satterfield was a great privilege. And each of the members of this team contributed equally to achieving this outcome, which is a great contribution to security in this region. And it's a great contribution to the strong and enduring relationship between the United States of America and Turkey. Lastly, I want to express my appreciation to millions of Americans who I know were carrying this moment in prayer. We heard from people all over the country whose hearts were heavy with the loss of life in this conflict over the last week, long to see it brought to an end. And I believe their prayers, the strong leadership that President Trump provided to this moment, and the cooperation with President Erdogan and Turkey has made this possible. So again, let me say, a week after Turkish forces crossed into Syria, Turkey and the United States of America have agreed to a ceasefire in Syria. It will be a pause in military operations for 120 hours while the United States facilitates the withdrawal of YPG from the affected areas in the safe zone. And once that is completed, Turkey has agreed to a permanent ceasefire. And the United States of America will work with Turkey, will work with nations around the world to ensure that peace and stability is the order of the day in this safe zone on the border between Syria and Turkey. With that, let me recognize Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, and thank you, Mr. Secretary, for your great work.
Thank you, Mr. President. Thanks. I think the Vice President said it well. I just wanted to add this thought. There obviously remains a great deal of work to do in the region. There's lots of challenges that remain, but this effort tonight sets the conditions for the successful resolution of this particular piece, which created enormous risk and a real risk of instability. And President Erdogan's decision tonight to work alongside President Trump to achieve this ends will be one that I think will benefit Turkey a great deal. Thanks. I know you want to take some questions.
Great. Humaira, where are you? Go right ahead.
Thank you very much. How will you overcome the damage that's been caused over the past week? There's been a lot of animosity between U.S. and Turkey. A lot of things have been said, and a lot of threats of economic sanctions have been made. How are you going to repair the relationship going forward? Thank you.
Well, first, as you'll see from the agreement, part of our understanding is that with the implementation of the ceasefire, the United States will not impose any further sanctions on Turkey. And once a permanent ceasefire is in effect, the president has agreed to withdraw the economic sanctions that were imposed this last Monday. But make no mistake about it, President Trump was very clear with our ally, Turkey, about American opposition to Turkish military forces entering Syria. President made that clear in his discussions and his correspondence with President Erdogan. And I believe that the candor and frankness that President Trump applied to this and the strength of his relationship with President Erdogan both contributed to the ability for this agreement to come about. And now we will work together to implement this agreement. As I said, our team is already working with YPG personnel in the safe zone for an orderly withdrawal outside the 20-mile mark. And we're going to go forward together to bring peace and security to this region. I'm very confident of that. Ganja Şenay. Ganja, please.
Thank you. Ganja Şenay from Charity World. There are reports by some international organizations on how YPG is treating ethnic and religious minorities in northern Syria. And Christian leaders in Turkey are making calls to the country to ensure peace and security in the region. I'm wondering your thoughts on this.
Well, let me let the Secretary also address that. But I can tell you that President Erdogan and I spoke at great length about the importance of protecting religious minorities in the region. President Erdogan also shared with me the perspective of many leaders in religious communities here in Turkey who had great concerns about violence and persecution taking place along the border. And so part of our agreement is to continue to work very closely to ensure that religious minorities can thrive and that religious pluralism is one of the characteristics of this safe zone for some time to come. Mr. Secretary?
Not only this, we've certainly heard from the Vice President, I heard from Christian leaders around the world who expressed much of the same concern that you just described. We think this reduction in violence, this ceasefire, reduces the risk of that, so we think this greatly contributes to protecting religious minorities throughout Syria and throughout the broader Middle East as well. This all obviously happens in the context of lots of religious challenges, lots of challenges of religious persecution in Iraq and other places. Well, we think this is an important contribution in that regard. The other thing is that we talked about at some length is that to the extent there are abuses that are identified, we'll ask each leader, certainly President Erdogan and his team and others, to investigate any allegations of abuse that have taken place.
And let me maybe add an addendum to that. One of the things I know the president and the American people are most proud of is the investment of hundreds of millions of dollars to help rebuild a Christian, Yazidi, and other religious minority communities in the aftermath of the horrifying violence during the ISIS period, both in Syria and in northern Iraq. We'll continue to flow those resources to support those communities. But as you'll see from this agreement, it is a specific undertaking by Turkey and by the United States to ensure to protect religious minorities in the affected region. Sean Tandon.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Vice President. You mentioned that there's an organized withdrawal of the YPG fighters. Can you explain that a little bit more? You said there's been an agreement with them, where they're going to withdraw to, what do you see of the future of them? And while there are obviously concerns here in Turkey about the YPG and the links to the PKK, many in Washington say, for example, that they led part of the fight against the Islamic State group, against ISIS. What do you see for the future of northern Syria? Do you see any future for the Syrian Kurds politically there?
Well, our commitment with Turkey is that we will work with YPG members, and we also know as Syria Defense Forces, to facilitate an orderly withdrawal over the next 120 hours. And let me say, that's literally already begun. And where they will be withdrawing from is the demarcation line, roughly 20 miles south of the border. Turkey's willingness to pause and to embrace a ceasefire of military operations to enable us to see to that orderly withdrawal of YPG will, we believe, make it possible for that to occur. And it, I know it's already underway as we speak. But look, the Turkey's had a great concern about their border. And while the United States of America did not approve of their military crossing into Syria, we have always endorsed a safe zone. And it was a matter of discussion and negotiations. And we believe that the Kurdish population in Syria, with which we have a strong relationship, will continue to endure. The United States will always be grateful for our partnership with SDF in defeating ISIS. But we recognize the importance and the value of a safe zone to create a buffer between Syria proper and the Kurdish population and the Turkish border, and we're going to be working very closely. So we think the agreement today first ends the violence, which is what President Trump sent us here to do. I said it again and again to President Erdogan. Is President Trump sent us here to end the violence and to achieve an immediate ceasefire. And thanks to the agreement that we negotiated today and the strong stand that President Trump took, in the preceding days, we've achieved that. We've also achieved an opportunity by working with YPG to move out of the area to create more peace and security and stability in that buffer zone. And we're going to be working very earnestly to accomplish that. We believe that can be accomplished during the 120-hour period, and after which there'll be a permanent ceasefire, and then we'll continue to engage. Again, not militarily. The president made it clear that we're not going to have military personnel on the ground. But the United States will continue to engage diplomatically, politically, and, of course, in humanitarian aid and support to affect all of the people affected in this region.
Last question.
Go ahead, Vice
President. Thank you, Vice President. You mentioned the United States
opposed Turkey's incursion into northern Syria, that Erdogan has always wanted a sort of safe zone here. What concessions did you actually get out of President Erdogan, number one? Number two, have you gotten specific assurances from the YPG that they will comply with the terms of this agreement, because this is something that they have said that they would not do? And finally, with the Kurds moving south, and now with the U.S. sanction in terms of them moving south, how would you address critics who would call this potentially a second abandonment of the Kurds?
Well, I think you'll be able to see from the agreement itself what concessions were made. President Trump, in his telephone call with President Erdogan earlier this week, and in the directive that he gave us to deliver, was very clear that he wanted a ceasefire. He wanted to stop the violence. Turkey's engaged in an active military operation. I can tell you that as our discussions began over the course of the five-hour period of time, we reached a place of agreement about how a ceasefire could benefit Turkey, achieve President Trump's objectives, and also contribute to a peaceful resolution of the safe zone. And I believe that we've accomplished that. With regard to the YPG, the Syrian Defense Forces, we have been in contact today, and we have received repeated assurances from them that they'll be moving out, that they greatly welcome the opportunity for a ceasefire, to make a safe and orderly withdrawal from those areas in the safe zone where they still have a presence. We're very confident that that's already taking place, and we're going to be using all the leverage that we have of having fought alongside Syrian Defense Forces in the battle against ISIS to facilitate their safe withdrawal. But we think this is an outcome that will greatly serve the interests of the Kurdish population in Syria. It'll greatly serve the interests of Turkey, and it'll create the kind of long-term buffer zone that will ensure peace and stability in the region.
Mr. Vice President, just want to follow up on that question. What specific concessions did Turkey receive? Specifically, I want to ask you if they brought the issue up of the bank, Halkbank, rather.
Not in the context of these negotiations. I think when we had concluded the negotiations, the topic was raised, and we informed them that that was a matter for the Southern District of New York and the Justice Department. But let me say the concessions that the United States made have to do with the fact that the president had made it clear that if there had not been a ceasefire today, there would have been a new round of massive sanctions against Turkey. And you'll see in the agreement that on the basis of the pause of 120 hours, a ceasefire over the next 5 days, that we will not be implementing additional sanctions during that period of time. Once we have a permanent ceasefire, following the orderly withdrawal of all YPG forces, the United States also agreed to withdraw the sanctions that were imposed on several cabinet officials and several agencies earlier this week.
To be clear, though, just to nail this down, so it was simply the sanctions that would be removed. Nothing else was offered or given to the Turks.
Right.
Thank you, Vice President.
Thank you, Mr. Vice President. While you are here negotiating with the Turks for several hours, both of you,
Can I finish real quick? Wait. You are using the YPG as a using the sanctions as a blackmail against your major ally for the sake of PKK YPG terrorist organization.
This is a clear question, Mr. Vice President.
The United States of America did not support Turkey's military action in Syria.
Note what Vice President said, because the media is twisting this. That's why I call them big lie media. They keep on repeating that Trump gave the green light to him. No, he didn't. This was a military action initiated by Turkey. And they've now backed down when the United States made very, very clear, if it didn't, as Trump said, we'll ruin your economy by imposing tariffs that will wreck your economy. Remember, Erdogan does face elections, but he also has a bigger problem. He has close to 4 million Syrians that the people of Turkey want to go back to Syria. That's what this is really about. And now that the Syrian civil war has been won by the Assad regime with the assistance of Russia military fighter aircraft, as well as the Iranian fighters, Turkey, as well as other countries, Jordan took people, Egypt, a number of countries took refugees. Erdogan has a legitimate complaint that the other nations around the area did not take anywhere close to that.
President Trump made that very clear to his friend President Erdogan. And the United States imposed sanctions earlier this week. And the president made it clear yesterday, and we made it clear again today, that there would be additional sanctions coming to bring an end to the violence, to the loss of innocent lives, in this border conflict. That being said, let me say, I really believe today's ceasefire is a credit to President Trump and to President Erdogan. It's a credit to the strong relationship between the United States and Turkey. It's also a credit to the strong relationship between our two leaders. I mean, where there are differences between friends, it's important that the friends let their feelings be known. President Trump did that in this case. But it facilitated us being able to reach an agreement that has now resulted in a ceasefire, and we believe will set the stage for creating a peaceful and stable, a safe zone, and the United States is committed to achieving that for all the people of this region.
That was it. I played all of it because this is important, folks. This could have led to a war. We wouldn't have declared it, though. Turkey backed down. But remember, what do we have? What does the United States have in Syria? Not much in terms of military forces. And Turkey knows that. We don't want to escalate that. And we have an air base in Turkey where we have nuclear weapons. So we'll see how this goes. I think it'll ultimately be a permanent ceasefire, and we'll learn more about where exactly the Kurds will be. I think they'll be where exactly they are, except the 20-mile buffer zone in Syria that borders on the Turkish border. And it's a long border. Now, what else was in the news? Today, the Senate was unable to overturn the veto, President Trump's veto. What both the House and the Senate wanted to do, and Trump said no way, Trump was refunding or reprogramming money in the defense budget for what? The wall. The border barrier, as I prefer to call it. So when a president vetoes a bill, it's up to the House and the Senate by a two-thirds vote to overturn it. They're not anywhere close. But that points up a major point here. They're both Democrats and Republicans that oppose Donald Trump's efforts to secure the border. As a matter of fact, all the presidential Democratic Party presidential candidates will say, I'm for open borders. What they really are for is to give citizenship to all the illegal aliens that are here. And they won't give them a penny to secure the border. And a lot of those people are also Republicans. Because most of the politicians, I won't say all, but most of the politicians, Democrats and Republicans, are bought and paid politicians. In other words, somebody is making large campaign contributions, and they want to be able to hire illegal aliens. They're cheap, compliant labor. That's what's going on. The American people, poll after poll after poll, and I've said this, but I always have to say it, the American people support legal immigration into this country, as do I. Now, I would also say the majority of the American people, in terms of legal immigration, think a million is too high. There are Democrats and Republicans that would like to make legal immigration 2 to 3 million, but the American people wouldn't sit still for that. But in polls on immigration, when you get to the illegal aliens that are here, the overwhelming majority of American people want that invasion roll back, as did Donald Trump when he ran for president. The reason why Donald Trump is president today, he took a very, very strong position on the illegal alien invasion of this country. And it was a two-part plan. One, to build the big, beautiful wall with the door in it. Has he built 1,000 miles? No, he'll be lucky to get a 500 by the end of next year. But that's 500 miles that wouldn't have been built if it were Democrats, for sure, and most of the Republicans. That's why he beat and got the nomination, because the American people want the invasion stopped, and they want it rolled back. And that was part two of the promise, that he would remove and deport all the illegal aliens that are here. Now, how many are here? They don't like to talk about it. Somewhere between 30 million and 60 million, not 11 million and not 20 million, 30 to 60 million, because why? It's been going on for 33 years. And for every one we apprehend, a minimum of 2 to 3 get in. So even though the apprehension numbers, at one time they were fairly consistent, being either slightly above or below a million, you multiply that by 2 or 3, it's 2 to 3 million a year. Yes, I would say 1 out of 3 goes home, but the other 2 stay here. And most of them have been since this has been going on for 33 years, a lot of these people have been here a long time. They live and work here, and they've had children here. And neither the Democratic Party nor the Republican Party has secured the border. This problem is festering and festering and festering, and the reason why was a lack of leadership from both parties. They all would say, oh, yeah, we're for the border barrier, but they wouldn't both authorize and appropriate money for it. Even when Trump won the first 2 years, the Republicans were in control of the House and the Senate. They could have given him $30 billion. It's not going to be cheap to build it, but they didn't. They didn't. Finally, I think Trump figured it out that, hey, listen, the Republicans are part of the problem, but the Democrats are not going to give me a cent. So once the House became controlled by the Democrats, he knew the only way he was going to get any money to build any span of border barrier was to reprogram money, and that's what he did. Has he fulfilled his promises in the immigration area? No. That's what, you see, my reservation about Trump is I didn't trust him. I didn't think he would do hardly anything. I thought this was a big PR campaign. So to the extent he builds or fulfills his 1,000-mile promise, that's better than nothing. We have 350 miles. I'm not counting any new construction. When Trump came in, there were 350 miles of fence that were designed to stop human beings. And that's the only mileage I count. Yeah, there's another 300 miles roughly to stop vehicles, but people can walk around, under, over it. So in my mind, you have a 2,000-mile border, you have 350 miles of fence, and Trump will build another 500 miles maybe by the end of next year. But you need a total of new construction of 1,500 miles. And he's going to, if he's lucky, build a third of that. He promised to build 1,000 of the 1,500 miles. But you're still going to have hundreds of miles without a barrier. And that's part one of the promise. You see, if it were fully funded, this could have been done in a year or two at most. Now, you do have some land that you have to get either buy, but you exercise eminent domain to get it. Either, you know, the government makes you an offer to buy it or have the rights to build the fence. And if they don't take it, then the government exercises the right of eminent domain and takes it. And it's legitimate because you want to protect the American people from, first, the fact that when you're talking millions of people over such a long period of time, this is fundamentally a jobs issue. And until you turn that magnet off, in other words, until you make it clear to those breaking into our country, and I need to say this because I forget this, but it needs to be pointed out and stressed. It's not just the U.S.-Mexican border. That's at least half the problem, maybe 2/3, somewhere between 50 and 60%. But what's the other part of the problem? You have people every single day flying in primarily. They can take ships, but primarily flying in as tourists, business people, and they overstay their visa. They like it here. Now, you heard the phrase, they're working in the shadows. Yeah, they're working, but if they're not in the shadows, so they're right out front. You can go in any retail store across this country and, oh, yeah, they have fraudulent documents, but you have illegal aliens that technically should be deported, removed and deported from this country. So it's not just people coming across the U.S.-Mexican border. The second part of the problem, and it's a large part, you know, I've heard estimates it's about 40%. Who knows? But it's not 1 or 2 million. When you're talking 30 to 60 million, 40% of 30 million, you can do the math. That's 12 million people. 60 million, what's that? 24 million. So even though I tend to focus on the border barrier, and that's a major piece, that's the majority, you also have to enforce immigration law and make sure the people that are overstaying their visas are sent home. And we're supposedly getting better at this. But what fundamentally is not getting the priority, if let's say it's 30 million, the low end, it would take 10 years at 3 million a year to get all the illegal aliens that are here, whether they came by plane or cross the U.S. border out of the United States, and we'd have to process them. Are we deporting 3 million people a year? No, we're not. You see, that's why I didn't trust Trump. He hasn't delivered on that. But I'm not naive. Do you think the Democrats are going to? No, they want to give citizenship to every single one that's here. Maybe they'll exclude murderers and rapists. But other than the hardcore criminal thugs, no. They want to give citizenship to all of them. And the American people say no, 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 no. And the elites in Washington, the so-called elites, I call them the incompetents or the hard of hearing. Why don't they listen? Because they think they can get away with it. The only way this is going to stop is that the American people finally say enough is enough. We need a new political party that listens to us and vote these Democrats and Republicans out of office. That's what it's going to take. Because quite frankly, President Trump is not moving fast enough. He's the only game in town and he knows it. But he also knows the one way, the only way that Trump is going to lose his support and not get a second term is double cross the people that voted for him for usually one or two issues. Primarily, it's the immigration issue. Now, I'm not saying there aren't people that voted for him because they thought he was going to fundamentally reduce taxes and reduce regulation. There are a lot of reasons to vote for him if he fulfills his promises. So the good news today is the Senate, they don't have the votes. This is a sort of an easy vote, though. Now, what is big lie media and why the Democrats, in my mind, panicking? They know if Donald Trump gets a second term, and let's say he gets a landslide victory, in other words, it's not going to be narrow, and if it's any of those, I call them the dirty dozen that are left, I can't take these people seriously. And I don't think the American people are foolish enough, given the success of the competitive free enterprise market capital system, to vote for any Democrat that is clearly a socialist. And that's Elizabeth Warren, and that is Bernie Sanders, and several of the other people that I don't think have a chance, but they're all far leftist. So I think Donald Trump is going to win big, but then he's going to have to deliver. And what I mean by that, number one, he has to build a total of new mileage of 1,500 miles of a border barrier that keeps the people out. And let me just say this a minute. I'll spend a minute on this. The only reason you have a border barrier is to give the U.S. Border Patrol some time once they see that someone's trying to break in to get to their spot and apprehend it. So you need a road, you need a barrier, actually you need two, but that's more expensive, and obviously you need sensors, cameras, drones, helicopters. And you need this equipment and the personnel to go with it because your focus is to, ideally, you want to prevent people from ever trying it. And to the extent that he can build this border barrier, it should dramatically, and I mean dramatically, slow down people that are trying to break in. They're going to try to break in no matter what. Ideally, they're going to go around. And most of that territory is desert. It's remote areas. You're miles away from anyone, and every summer and winter, for that matter, too, they die in the desert. That is continued. We need to stop encouraging people to break in, and it hasn't happened, folks, because our Congress is not listening to the people. They're doing what the people that make the big bucks contributions want to do, and they want cheap labor. Do you really think the Democrats care about the illegal alien? No. This is a way for them to keep power. Their plan is to try to turn this country into a single-party nation, somewhat similar to California, so they don't face opposition. They already control the schools, the colleges, the bureaucracy, what I call big lie media, your television networks, the newspapers, and they're coming after your wealth and money. and they want to give citizenship to people who have broken in. You have to make it very clear to everybody that it's a new regime, a new sheriff. No longer we're going to let people just walk into the country or fly into the country and take jobs away from American citizens. That's what they're doing. If you want to know why the American people resent it, two reasons. One, they have children and grandchildren that needs entry-level jobs. And most of these jobs, not all of them, but many of these jobs are entry-level manual labor. Some are very, very good paying jobs, factory jobs, construction jobs. And the illegal aliens get them because they're willing to work less than Americans. Doesn't mean it's necessarily minimum wage. Don't fall into that trap. Less than 3% of the American workforce, including illegal aliens, are paid minimum wage. What I'm saying is the illegal aliens will take jobs that require skills, but they're going to work for less than your average American would. And Americans in the past, the present, and the future do these jobs. Don't buy this argument, well, these are not jobs that Americans won't do. Yeah, they'll do them if you provide what the left would call a living wage. Where are we? Well, we're about 12 months away from 2020 election day, a little over 12 months. And the American people better pay attention. I hope I'm right. If I'm wrong, how could I be wrong? What if the Democrats win the presidency and gain control of the House and the Senate? What are you going to do? Could that happen? It could happen. Do I think it's going to happen? I don't think it's going to happen at all. But what if I'm wrong? What are you going to do? I don't think the American people are going to let the Democratic Party, and for that matter, Republicans that support giving citizenship to all the illegal aliens that are here. And that's exactly what they want, because the calculation of the Democratic Party is they will get at least 2 out of 3, if not 3 out of 4, of all those illegal aliens that become citizens. They will get them as Democratic registered voters. And if you're a tennis player, game, set, match, because that will enable the Democratic Party for many, many years into the future to control you and me. This is high stakes, and they're not giving up. However, they're revealing themselves, which is really good for what they really stand for. Although lie about it and spin it as best they can. But the American people are awake. They're paying attention. Now, I'll be the first to say, unfortunately, at least half the people in this country, American citizens, don't vote. Don't vote. They're not paying attention. They need to pay attention, but they're not. Now, I point that out, but that's an opportunity. That means you can create a new party and take on the Democrat and Republican Party. You need to replace one of them. Right now, I think the weakest is the Democratic Party, but that could change. You need a party that believes in the United States Constitution, believes in a representative republic, believes in balanced budgets, and believes that the American citizen comes first, not illegal aliens that have taken advantage of our system. Now, the last story I'm not going to spend much time on, but since I'm broadcasting from Dallas, Texas, Rick Perry was governor for Texas several terms, then became Secretary of Energy for Donald Trump. What's interesting, when he was running for president, I believe in 2012, was for eliminating the Department of Energy, the very department that he runs. So am I, but he forgot, if you recall the incident. Well, there are three agencies or department I would close, but he forgot one of them. And that, if you think about it, is the last time, I won't say any politician, people became aware that, well, there's at least one politician that wants to close one department. Now, if you're a regular listener to the show, you know, when you're in this financial mess, and that's exactly what it is, it's taken decades to get so bad. You can't blame any one person. What do you do? What do businesses do when there's a severe recession? Oh, yeah, they tighten their belts, but what do? They say, okay, what are our core functions? What do we absolutely must do? And the rest are laid off and departments are eliminated. We're way beyond that, folks. But neither party is up to the task of downsizing the federal government. That's what I'm advocating. To save this country, you're going to have to downsize the government. And that's just the first step. That means eliminating at least 8, if not 10, departments. There's not a Democrat recommending that, and there are no Republicans either. That's how bad the situation is. But what's the real problem? Those unfunded liabilities, obligations. We don't have the money. We didn't invest the money. What does that mean? Entitlement programs such as Medicare and Social Security and Medicare are going to have to be cut. That's not popular, folks. Especially amongst people, including me, that to varying degrees are dependent upon it. Many of these people are not coming back to work, but then they suddenly, whoops, we have to cut it. Or, and it's really going to be a combination, we're going to dramatically have to increase taxes, payroll taxes, of people that are still working. Remember, our Medicare and Social Security are what are called pay-as-you-go. The people that are working or paying for the benefits of those that qualify for the benefits. For Medicare, it's age 65. For Social Security, 66, 67. They're in trouble. Both of those programs are in trouble. The biggest one is Medicare. So you can ignore the problem, kick the can down the road, but the problem just gets bigger and worse. We've wasted decades where we could have been very deliberate and rational about this, but we didn't have politicians with courage. Very few politicians would even talk about this. Forget about trying to do something about it. And today we have two political parties, Democrats, Republicans, take your pick. And we've gotten into the very bad habit of voting for one, either one, and neither of them are up to the job. There's not a leader among them that will take this on, and it needs to be taken on. And I'm including Donald Trump. He doesn't want to do anything about it. He figures, well, I'll get reelected in 2020, and in 2024, I'll go play golf. Let Mike Pence try to figure it out, assuming he gets elected. Now, let me say, there are politicians, Democrats and Republicans, are aware of the situation. And that's the first step. You got to be aware of the size, the scope of the problem. But then you need the courage, and that's really what's missing, to try to explain to the American people the extent of the problem and what needs to be done. I'm not hearing any politician. I mean, I know I go on and on about this, and there's a few talk show hosts that go on and on about this. But we're few and far between, and in my mind, and I've questioned this, the only thing that's going to address it is a new political party, because I've given up on both of these parties. These are big spending parties. I call them Santa Claus socialism. Vote for me, I'll give you free stuff. Well, there's no such thing as free stuff, and we've given out so much free stuff, we can't do it anymore. And it's going to happen. There'll be a day of reckoning, and bang, a big tax increase, bang. Cuts in Medicare, bang. Cuts in Social Security, bang. Cuts in Medicaid. And then what happened? The people that have been lending money to the United States government are going to say, we want an additional 3%, 4%, 5%, an additional, not the total interest, an additional 3 or 4 or 5%. Why? Because the United States will become a bad risk. Oh, yeah, we can tax our citizens to death. And if you do that, what happens? Growth is not at an average of 3.5%. It's under 2%. All of these things are connected, and very few leaders can connect the dots. And even if they can and understand the problem and want to do something about it, you need courage, because the establishment, the political elitist establishment of both parties, especially the leadership, that's the last thing they want to do. That's the very last thing they want to do. And all of them are hoping that when this happens, they will be out of Congress. And it's not just Congress. I need to emphasize that. It's the bureaucracy that wants the status quo. The way I look at it, they want the status quo to remain because they benefit from the status quo, even though ultimately it comes crashing down. We need a person with vision, courage, insight to tackle it. If you think you're going to get it from either the Democrat or Republican Party, including Donald Trump, you're sadly mistaken. He's built maybe Bill's 500 miles. How many millions, tens of millions of illegal aliens has he deported? The answer is none. With that, thank you for listening. And now, America the Beautiful. My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of KDUX Web Radio, Richland College, or the Dallas County Community College District. You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas. We're the voice of Richland College. You are listening to the Pronk Pop Show, presented by Raymond Thomas Pronk, the People's Paladin Pronk, propagating faith, family, friends, freedom first. Broadcasted by Renaissance Radio, Radiating Reason, and KDUX Web Radio. Podcasted by ProcPops.wordpress.com and KDUX Web Radio.wordpress.com.